Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome back to the Roker Report podcast in association with Volks Brewery. We've had a change-up in host this week. Alex has been given a rest as he's picked up some kind of minor knock, flu or something like that, he said. And you've got me, Graham, or the Scottish one, as some of you prefer. Sunland and Phil Parkinson have continued to be absolutely garbage this week. I have a star-studded show today, alongside myself, as Sunland legend Gary Bennett. How are you doing, Gary?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good, good. Total Sport host, Simon Pride. You well, Simon?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You were here nice and early, earliest one.
I was, yes. Thank you for pointing that out.
Don't want to dob Gary in it, but... And the second dressed best man in the Northeast, Nick Barnes. How are you doing, Nick?
Very good. Very good. Thank you.
Do you agree with my summarisation, second best?
I'm trying to think who's first.
Me.
Benno.
Oh. My excuse is the big screen blocking my view of you, so I can't quite see how well dressed you are.
I was going to say Benno, but I was going to say not Benno, sorry, but I kind of disagree. I seen him with David Speedy a few years ago, so I'm keeping myself to myself.
That's got to be a record. I mean, every time Benno gets interviewed, David Speedy gets mentioned. Exactly. But within the first minute, that is pretty good going.
It's his fault.
That's what I'm remembered. That's what I'm remembered for, not me 23 spectacular goals. But anyway.
But it's a link with Coventry, you see, so that's quite relevant. It's
right,
relevant.
Okay.
Back to more depressing news, I guess. Sunderland have had two games this week. The first one was Gillingham. So we crashed out of the FA Cup for the first round since losing to Oldham Athletic in 1924. We had no shots on target in 120 minutes, but as Phil Parkinson said, we did roll our sleeves up and give it a right go, or so he thinks. Brandon Taylor played kind of all right, weren't too bad, but we will start with the Gillingham game. And I'll start with you, Simon. What did you make of the Gillingham game?
Well, I wasn't at that one. These two had the privilege of covering that one. So I listened to what they had to say.
To
be honest, I tuned in and out. I was at home and... doing other stuff, listen for a bit and then turn it on. And then by the end, when I tuned in towards the end of extra time, I tuned in and there was actually just a period of silence. Neither of them spoke when I turned the radio on. I think that what was, you probably back this up, that's what the game had come to. It was basically just, there was nothing happening. I think you were just waiting for penalties because it didn't look like anyone was going to break the deadlock. Obviously, Gillingham did in the end. But it just sounded, and from what Gary was saying, I mean, I think Gary, you said in commentary that it was probably the worst game that you could remember covering with Nick. And bearing in mind, you've been doing it for a long, long time, that probably tells a story. And yeah, just absolutely dreadful. I went onto the BBC Sport website to watch the inverted commas highlights. And I think it was 52 seconds managed to find or something like that. And so that probably tells a story in itself. You've already mentioned not a single shot on target. And it's a sad indictment. That coming off the back of a couple of other dreadful performances. I mean, the Scunthorpe game in the Football League Trophy, obviously dreadful as well against a team that was in a division below. So it was, just seemed like they were kind of staggering from one low to the next. The away performances in particular, just completely uninspiring. And there were clearly huge, huge problems. And that Gillingham game illustrated that. Very depressing.
You mentioned the comment that obviously Benno made. Gary, when it comes to... I mean, I'm lucky enough to remember the 90s when everything was great. And I remember we had a lot of characters in there that genuinely would roll up their sleeves and always give it a good go. I'm a bit surprised by his comments, Gary, that he said he felt like the lads give it a right good go. Did you see that? Did you see it was a right good go? Or do you think he's just giving platitudes and saying false statements, basically?
You can't question the effort. It was a difficult game. You know what Gillingham's all about. they haven't got the, shall we say, the technical ability what some of the, well, so-called Swindon players have got, especially when you look at it on paper. So, you know, what they've got to obviously make up with is effort. And that's something which they did. And we got caught up in, shall we say, their long ball game. And they're better at it than us. And to go 120 minutes without having one shot on goal, you know, the only shot we had was from Will Grigg. But I think the overall display from ourselves was poor. And, yeah, you know, we were finding it very difficult. And especially when we finish games, I think sometimes we obviously look back or reflect back on maybe the commentary or how we see in the game, and then listen to the manager's post-match interviews as well to see if we've got it right. And I would say nine times out of ten, we usually get it right. But I've got to say the last two or three occasions, I think how the manager sees the game and how we've actually put the game across, I think there's a little bit of a gap in regards of that. And
like the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, you know, to put it in a roundabout way. And yeah, and sometimes, you know, we look back on ourselves and think, are we being a little bit critical of the players? Have we gone over the top? But I think, you know, when we look back on, especially against the game against Tuesday, I think a lot of the support, especially the 329 supporters who went to Gillingham and the people who listened to the game as well, agreed how we seen the game.
Coming to you as well, Nick, it's kind of difficult to fill in any sort of space of time with that Gillingham game. It was so, so bad. But, and I'm going to remove Luke 09 out of this, but I sometimes think effort and desire, I think there's a desire that's lacking there. But what did you make of the game on Tuesday, Nick?
A colleague of mine texted me during the game and said, because he was having to follow it online for the BBC, and his word to me was turgid. And, yeah, and I couldn't disagree. I mean, it was awful. It was a dreadful game to commentate on, and there were very, very few redeeming factors that came out of it. You know, as Benno says, I don't doubt that the players went out there and they were, you know, committed to work hard and try and make something of it. But it was such a mishmash. And then when it ended up being long ball, high ball, and Benno making the point that there seemed to be more headers in that game than anybody, you know, kicking the ball, it was turgid and frustrated afterwards by, you know, it happened at Scunthorpe the week before, Phil Parkinson's post-match comments bear no relation really to the match that you've just watched. But I know I've got a sense now, because it happened again after Coventry, that Phil Parkinson's coming out and he's defending his team. But then when you speak to him pre-match, as I did, you know, before the Coventry game, he's much more open about some of the problems that are clearly within that set of players. I mean, you know, one such instance is this, after Grant Leadbitter said after Scunthorpe that they're not all sort of rowing in the same direction, and then there are factions within the dressing room which need to be addressed. And that's something that Phil Parkinson didn't shy away from on Friday when I spoke to him. He didn't deny that that wasn't the case. Just said that, yes, it's not as bad as perhaps people perceive it to be. So there's a sort of an admission there that things aren't quite right. But there are, you know, there are a lot of problems at the moment. And we've said numerous times in the last few weeks, it's worrying, it's a concern that you can go from a team that, while they lost at Shrewsbury, they had, I don't know how many chances, and they should really have come away with something, to a team that turned up at Gillingham and didn't have a shot on target. And you can't just flick a switch and hope that when Coventry roll up, you're going to play Brazilian football and beat, you know, Coventry 5-0. And that was the case, you know, against Coventry. Again, it was a better performance, but it was still frustrating.
Talking about sort of the factions that are in the dressing room, I think Grant Leadbitter really did pretty much write it down on paper for us for that interview you did, I think, after the Scunthorpe game, I think it was. But with the team itself, we weren't playing great under Jack Ross, and there was a reason he was sacked, right? But why have we gone progressively worse under Parkinson? Can that be, I mean, I'll come to you, Simon, with this. Do you think anything can be pointed at Parkinson with that? Because obviously we have got considerably worse under him in a really short space of time.
Yeah, and that seems to be a lot of people's opinion. And obviously you have to factor in as well that 5-0 win over Tranmere. And everyone thought, yeah, oh, actually, you know, maybe he's doing something here. I heard him described as maybe a sort of League One version of Sam Allardyce, getting things a bit simpler than they were under Jack Ross. And, you know, maybe just finding a way to win games that they hadn't previously when they were drawing so many. But then since then, it has gone completely downhill. Now the manager obviously has to take some share of responsibility for that. It takes any manager a degree of time to stamp his authority on a team, on a club, and to get his ideas across. And so I suppose, you know, you have to give him a bit of leeway because of that. But certainly, you know, you haven't really been able to see in any of the games since then that that they are progressing, have you? It's if anything, gone backwards, which is a big concern, and something which I've noticed in, you know, the interviews that Nick and others have done with him is he's making quite a lot of excuses. There's no other way to describe it, really. He's talking about injuries. He's talking about all sorts of other factors, which he's almost like distancing himself from the things that are going wrong, which again is a little bit concerning. All right, you know, he does have problems, particularly in terms of the strikers, with the injuries that he's got, and the fact that Will Grigg is simply not producing the goods at the moment. So he really doesn't have a functioning striker, does he? Let's be honest. So, you know, there are mitigating circumstances, certainly, to the way things are going. But it's difficult to understand why things have got worse. Maybe there is something to do with this talk of factions or in the dressing room. Maybe some players are miffed that Jack Ross got sacked. And I mean, you know, some have been accused of maybe downing tools a little bit, which there's absolutely no excuse for that. You know, no matter who the manager is, all right, you know, the previous manager got sacked because of the way that those players were playing, didn't he? So, if they then take a huff and stop performing even to that level, well, it reflects more on them probably than the new manager. But certainly, you know, in a very short space of time, a lot of pressure is now on Phil Parkinson's shoulders. Some people have even said that after the Coventry game, you know, that Kim Pioca's goal actually has saved him his job. I mean, that's somebody said that on the BBC Newcastle phone-in after the game. So I don't think that would be the case. I think Parkinson obviously is going to get a bit more time than that, but he's already under a heck of a lot more pressure than he would want to be after so few games in charge.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned something really strongly there, and I think I wrote something about this during the week before the Coventry game. I was vocally felt Jack was the wrong man. Truth be told, if I knew Parkinson was going to come in, I would have probably kept him. I don't think Parkinson's the right man, but I think you're right in what you're saying. If any of those players have taken the huff because Jack Ross lost his job, they need to remember why Jack Ross lost his job and it was their performances. But you've touched on Grant Ledbetter, and I wanted to ask you, Gary, there is factions in the dressing room. I think many of us have heard it, and Grant Ledbetter has pretty much confirmed it. As a captain, what does Grant Ledbetter do in that dressing room?
I think, you know, you look at Grant Ledbetter, he's been in, you know, many changing rooms. I think if anybody knows Grant, the way he goes about his football, the way he goes about his life is most probably totally, totally different to majority of footballers. You know, he likes to keep himself to himself, but also he likes to do things professionally as well. And, you know, if there's certain things which happen not just on the field, but in the changing rooms or off the field, shall we say, he's a man who, or a player who, you know, he'll most probably bring it to the managers or say something about it where he'll talk his mind, you know, speak his mind. You know, he likes to do things right. Grant Ledbetter is what you can call, he's a footballer. He likes to get the ball into his feet. He likes to play, you know, and the long ball, which we've been playing recently, doesn't suit Grant Ledbetter. And I think one thing which you do find or you see with Grant, he cares. And I think that hurts him, that he most probably thinking there's one or two players in the changing room who, shall we say, doesn't hurt. Losing games doesn't hurt. And I think that sort of annoys him. And, you know, Nick's just touched on about characters. You look at Sunderland Football Club at the present moment, you look at the team, and the big question is, where's the characters? There is no characters. There's no leaders.
Where's the Benno?
Yeah.
You know,
seriously, where is the Benno?
You know, there's no leaders there. And, you know, we did the programme on Friday, Total Sport, and we, you know, okay, we laugh about certain things in regards of Will Grigg and the manager going round to his house, you know, and yeah, it's funny at the time, but, you know, that is a serious, serious matter.
Yeah.
You know, little things like that. And then, you know, I listened to the interview yesterday, the post-match interview with Phil Parkinson coming out about Kim Pioca. You know what Kim Pioca is. You know, he's a player. He's full of smiles. He's full of joy and all this. And we knew that we put him on the pitch. And you're thinking, yeah, well, try to get some of that, bag it and give it to Will Grigg.
Yeah.
You know, but again, I supported Will Grigg yesterday because, you know, it's easy to pinpoint or point the finger at certain individuals. And, you know, Will Grigg, you've got to play to his strengths. You know, he's not one who's going to run the channels. You know, you look at the game yesterday against Coventry City. The ball's going into the box. How many's in the box? One person, Will Grigg. If you don't find Will Grigg, you're not going to score goals. The more people you have in the box, the more opportunity you've got of scoring goals. And that's how we create. That's how we got the equaliser yesterday. Yeah. The equaliser, we had three or four people in the box. And it's fallen to Kim Pioca. He was able to put the ball in the back of the net.
And it's as soon as Watmore and Kim Pioca came
exactly.
in as well. And it's like, but I wanted to, before we go into the match in full, I wanted to just come to you, Nick, as well. And maybe I'm being harsh here, and I suppose you can tell me if I am or not. But I think yesterday when I was at the game, I levelled at a lot of the players, because as you do, you vent at matches and sometimes you can be a bit harsh. But we're talking about characters. But the worst thing for me yesterday, and I'm not going to name anyone specifically, and certainly didn't think Will Grigg was one that was shirking his responsibility. I can see you put the effort in. But there were some players on that pitch that just weren't taking the lead that maybe Lugo 9 does, and they were almost cowardly. There was points when there was a simple, easy decision to make to win a ball, press a player, and it wasn't just about showing character yesterday, it was about them not being cowards. And that's how it came across to me yesterday, and has came across in a while. But how do you get a player, just to kind of defend Parkinson a bit and play devil's advocate, how do you get a player, Nick, to start showing character? Does that not have to come from in themselves?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it clearly does. I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the last few weeks about the players taking responsibility for the position that the club's in at the moment. And there's a lot in that. And, you know, I think it's interesting looking at the way that both Jack Ross worked and the way that Phil Parkinson works. And both of them, in fairness to the pair of them, have been very candid off the record. I think Phil Parkinson's very defensive on the record because he's trying to exude positivity, if you like. He's trying to get a message out there that we will get it right. It will turn around. Let's all be positive. Let's all head in the same direction. But actually, when you speak to him off the record, he's very open about individual players, about what they're doing with individual players, what they're trying to do within the group. But I come back to Benno's point about, I think it is a passive squad. I don't think there aren't. I mean, the characters you've got in there are very insular characters, and people like Aidan McGeady, who cares about his football, but is actually quite a selfish footballer in the sense that it's very much all about him, if you like, rather yeah. than the team necessarily. Chris Maguire, again, is very inconsistent. But again, he's not an ebullient character in terms of standing in the middle of the pitch and shouting at his teammates and cajoling them and trying to get them playing. You haven't got anybody in the squad that is of that ilk, which is probably what it needs. It needs someone to, you know, grab someone by the scruff of the neck, if you like, and even if it's at half time, and throw them against the wall and shout at them and get them G'd up. I mean, you know, Lugo 9 is a perfect example of a player that if you had 11 Lugo 9s, you'd have a very, very good team spirit, and you'd have a probably a technically flawed squad, but you'd have a squad that is fueled up, energetic, and probably very well suited to League One. So what you've got at the moment is parts which aren't coming together. And parts at the moment which are coming together under a manager who historically has preferred to play long ball football and, you know, has been champing at the bit to get Charlie White back into the team so he can sort of change the style and the system. And what I was talking about yesterday in the build-up to the game, I was talking to Phil Smith and James Hunter about the worry for me now is that in January, all the talk of having to bring four or five players in, and suddenly, 18 months down the line, when we were looking for stability and trying to move forward, we're in a position where we're talking about major surgery again and starting again, starting from scratch, and then hoping that in 5 months you can, you know, rebuild the squad and get out of League One. When I'm beginning to think this is going to be another season in League One, another rebuilding process.
It's scary. We will move on to the game, but we've got the three-word review from the fans. There's at least 95% of it calling for Parkinson to go. A lot of swear words, and probably quite rightfully so, but we'll pick out the ones that didn't include swearing, because pretty much all of them did. Understandably. Mm-hmm. Michael Donaghy says, bring back Jack. Don't agree with that. CTD_Sunderland lad, I think that says. Sunderland lad, there we go. Games in hand. Fair enough. Anthony Watson says, play Benji Tuesday. I think everyone can echo that sentiment. Tom Dowson says, recall Ethan Robson. Liam Angus says, finishing below Bolton. Not sure on that, Liam. Metronome, never ending nightmare. Yep. Mike Taylor, falling out of love. I can understand that. Hannah Brown, papering over cracks at LPH says, now, I don't know if anyone remembers, this is quite good, this, Nissan trip needed. If anyone remembers, I didn't really help the David Moyes. Didn't help the David Moyes either too much there, LPH. Jordan Gowland says, League One forever. Neil Brown says, Bolton destroyed him. I don't know. Oh, Phil Parkinson. All right, I thought he was referring to Jack Ross. I was like, I think, well. SAFC Wilkes might survive relegation. You never know. And Hair Lip, attendance is dropping soon. Yep. So just moving on to a little bit about yesterday's game, and I'll try and keep it as short and as nice and as even as possible. We were crap. From pretty much start to finish, I think we've mentioned about, I mean, yesterday I was sitting there, obviously, with Ashley, with my girlfriend, and we were sitting watching the game. And when the goal went in, I didn't even react to it. I didn't even react. I was annoyed. The only time I reacted was when I realised it was Benji that scored, and it was like, that's nice. That's nice for him. But again, and this is my opinion. I'm not going to push my opinion on anyone, but I just felt like it was a cowardly performance front to back, apart from Luke O'Neill, who I think always tries his best. And I was trying to pinpoint out yesterday the people around me. If you look at Luke O'Neill and the desire that he shows to get there first and actually make something happen. And Denver Hume a little bit yesterday, to be fair to him. And I know people don't always agree with that, but Denver did try a bit yesterday. But there was 9 or 10 players there not showing a level of desire. And then ended up where like a pretty turgid Coventry side, to be honest. They didn't do much. I can't remember them having that many chances, or Birch having that much to do. We were just that bad. And I suppose we somehow got out of it in the end, didn't we? But Simon, what did you make of yesterday's abysmal, horrible performance?
It wasn't great, was it? It wasn't great. I heard Gary saying afterwards that it was certainly better than Gillingham. It was nowhere near as bad as that. And so I suppose, you know, that's one slight positive to take. I probably wouldn't agree with you in terms of it being cowardly. And I mean, I've seen some of the teams, and I think you can sort of cite maybe the team that got relegated under Moyes from the Premier League and some of the players that were in the side then, and indeed in the Championship season. I think there were certainly cases then when, you know, players had, they didn't care. There were some players in that team that clearly weren't bothered what was going to happen to Sunderland. It was all about them. I think, to be honest, yesterday, I think most of the players were trying, were giving it their all. And to be fair to them, they did get back into the game. They did keep going and they got that equaliser, you know. So to an extent, there has to be a bit of credit for that. I don't think that what you're talking about there, the lack of quality, I don't think it was down to players not showing or even not necessarily, you know, not wanting the ball. I think they did. I think it is just a lack of quality and a lack of confidence. I think those are the two main factors. I think on the whole, you know, the desire was there, and the fact that they came back into it and got that point, I suppose that will at least maybe give them something to cling on to after the game. I mean, it is difficult watching them. That's the first match I've seen live under Phil Parkinson. So I was trying to work out what his style of football was. Certainly, you can tell that he would rather have a big striker. It was difficult to see what the game plan was. Quite a lot of the time, it seemed that, you know, he had Leadbitter sitting in front of the back four. It seemed that Dobson and Power were there to run around a bit and to, you know, when Sunderland didn't have the ball, to close down, try and win it back. When Sunderland did have the ball, maybe to try and get forward and support the front players. But, you know, the ball was getting played up quickly and Sunderland weren't often retaining it. That's not Will Grigg's role. McGeady and Maguire were, for large parts of the game, Maguire in particular, completely ineffective, I felt. So
very poor yesterday.
Yeah,
Maguire, I felt.
Yeah. So, hey, you know, there was certainly, it didn't look very coherent, generally, the performance. Will Grigg still is a huge issue. I get what Gary says about, you know, the fact that they're not play to his strength. So I feel a bit sorry for him to that extent. But I think, you know, as the game went on, his movement became less and less. He became more disillusioned. I think when Watmore came on, that was maybe time for him to come alive again, because Watmore was getting down the right-hand side, wasn't he? He was getting balls in. There was one moment that kind of struck me. I was watching Will Grigg, even when the ball was nowhere near him, and just seeing, and he was still trying to make runs, but it seemed a bit half-hearted. And there was a couple of times when Watmore was getting the ball, you could see what he was going to try and do, get down the outside, get a ball in. And he did that on one occasion, pulled the ball back, and Grigg had just kind of, he wasn't even moving from the penalty spot. It was the time you come alive, make a run, either near post, back post, get away from your man. But he just didn't. And he was taken off not long after that. His shoulders were down. He came off, and that rather kind of summed up the game for me. So yes, it was really poor. I don't think it's down to lack of effort, though. I just do think it's down to a lack of quality, a lack of confidence, and perhaps still players not quite sure what the pattern of play should be, what the tactics are.
What do you make of the game, Gary?
Yeah, I agree with Simon. You know, we asked that question yesterday. What was the formation? You know, where's Aidan McGeady supposed to be playing?
Anywhere he wants, by the looks of it.
You know, the amount of times, you know, he's outside our 18-yard box or inside our 18-yard box or receiving the ball in the D on the halfway line. You know, sometimes you think he's just getting in the way. You know, you need him as an outlet. You need him further up the field. Now, Duncan Watmore came on for the last 15 minutes. He gave us width and straight away, when you received the ball, it was an outlet and you just passed it out wide and Duncan was in. You know, he gave us a little bit of pace. You know, I don't know what role Max Power was playing. I think Dobson as well were lost. And I think that's something which they need to sort out. And we've been talking about this in regards of formation. We're talking about pattern of play. You know, we see this week in, week out. What is our pattern of play? You know, you look at Coventry. They had a style or a pattern of play. And when they went forward with a little bit of tempo.
Yeah.
When Coventry had the ball at the back, you know, the amount of time they had on the ball was unbelievable. They had so much time to receive it, to pass it. There was no pressure from Sunderland. Maybe the players were told just to drop off, let them have it, let them, you know. But when we had the ball, we were put under pressure. How many times did we put the ball out? How many times did we miscontrol the pass? Because all of a sudden, they were willing to press. And it looks as though when we're coming up against opponents, they seem to be at least a yard or 2 yards quicker than us. I don't know why.
We lack a lot of pace and energy in the middle. And I think the comment you made there is maybe where my cowardly feelings come from, is that there wasn't anyone pressing. There was no one that wanted that. I don't think a footballer ever goes on the pitch not wanting to win, and maybe I'm using the wrong word. I think I just want someone, you know, when people talk about pressure at Sunderland, it's League One. It's League One. How can you, like, if you've got anything about yourself as a professional footballer, League One in Sunderland is not a pressurising football club.
Well,
it's just not.
Sorry. Well, again, you know, people have been talking about Catamol. His name's been brought up a few times. You know, are you missing a league, Catamol? You're missing somebody of his calibre, somebody who's got that will, that heart to go and close people down, you know, somebody who wants to win.
And one thing that triggers other people to then go and
do it. Exactly, well, exactly. So you know, we talk about, you know, the will, have they got it? You know, one thing which you can't coach is a heart.
Yeah.
You can coach anything else. You can't coach a heart. You either got it in you or you haven't. You know, Aidan McGeady, you know, no matter how much coaching you do, he's not going to be one who's going to go and close the ball down and get hit in the face or whatever. There's no way that's going to happen. You know, and I think there was a part of the game yesterday when Dobson lost the ball in the middle of the park and his reaction was poor.
Yeah.
And now that might be down to confidence. You know, okay, people are going to misplace passes. People are going to lose the ball. It's what you do after it. You know, you're looking for a reaction and that's what you want.
I think it happened a lot as well. I'm vocally quite a big fan of Dobson, but it wasn't one of his best games yesterday. It felt like he made a few misplaced passes in the first half and then he sort of lost it a bit after that and his head went down. And it just frustrates me that I can see Luke O'Neill never letting his head go down and yet the other 10 week on week seem to. But Nick, what did you make of the game yesterday?
It's been encapsulated pretty well by Pridey and Benno. I mean, I think it is a confidence issue to an extent. I think there are other factors yesterday. I mean, I'm not sure how much it comes into play, but I think if you're lacking confidence, I mean, Power and Dobson, I think I'm right, Dobson was on 4 yellow cards, Power's on 4 yellow cards, and Dobson picked up a 5th yesterday. Whether that's played on their minds, as well as this sort of eking lack of confidence over the last fortnight, where you can see it's been sucked out of the players. And the other issue, this issue about pressure and pressing the opposition. Now, we did have a long conversation with Phil Parkinson about this the other day, which is something they're looking to address. Nick Allenby's come in as the performance coach, and we were talking about all the statistics about it all. And the problem with this squad is that it's running in games 2.5 kilometres in the first 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and then it's running out of steam. So he's trying to find a balance at the moment of trying to get that sort of energy level in the team for 90 minutes. And I think, and I don't know for certain, I'm going to chat to Phil about this tomorrow, is that what he did in leaving Watmore and Kimpioka, well, Kimpioka would have been left on the bench anyway, but leaving Watmore on the bench, I think was with a view to bring him on later in the game, to up the levels again, to give them that energy. But I think it backfired because Dobson, Power, Maguire didn't perform yesterday. They didn't turn up. And I think that then skewed the whole game, because you trusted those players to go out there and put in those energy levels, and they just weren't doing it. And clearly when Watmore came on, it changed the game, because suddenly you had a player was running at defenders, was causing Coventry problems down that flank. So there are issues there. There are clearly issues that have got to be addressed. And, you know, a lot of it is to do with the balance in the middle. Now, Phil says that his first choice midfielders are Power and Dobson. Why? Because they're tall, they're athletic, and they can run, because they haven't got anybody else of that ilk in the squad. Now, Dobson, like you, I agree with you. I think he's, you know, as a character, he's very much like Luke O'Neill.
Yeah.
To speak to, his enthusiasm, his desire, his willingness. He's an experienced midfielder, and he's played, you know, how many games? He's played over 100 whatever his games in
just
League 1, League
22.
2. Yeah. And so there was something clearly affecting him yesterday. That wasn't the Dobson we've come to expect.
No.
Pulling together, we made this point about the last 2 weeks and these cup games and the form slowly, inexorably getting worse and worse. And we said going into the game against Coventry, you can't just flick a switch and suddenly turn up and play like Brazil. I think it was a better performance yesterday than we'd seen over the past fortnight. But my fear going into the game was that with the pace that Coventry had, they were going to run away with it in the first half. And they could, on another day, have been 3 or 4 nil up at half time. And my fear was that was going to happen. Mm. You know, we were going to get another scenario last season, when suddenly they were going to be 2-3 nil down by the break and game over. But at least, as Pridey says, there was a doggedness about them, and Coventry didn't offer anything in the second half. And that doggedness paid off in the end with that, you know, change in bringing on Watmore and Kimpioka. So there are some seeds and sort of fruit. There's some foundations to build on. But I think, you know, I keep thinking back to now is that Parkinson's got a limp up to January, and just hope that they stay in touch with the teams in the top six places, because yesterday's results didn't really help them too much. And that, you know, it's heat pressure on the game against Burton now.
So we'll go to sort of questions from the listeners, Ready Go users, Twitter and whatnot. Some really good ones, actually. There's one that really does stick out to me, and I suppose it's what a lot of people maybe are asking, despite it being only, I think, 2 months that Parkinson's been in the job. From Ready to Go, the user Griswold says, and I'll put this towards you, Simon. Charlie Methven said on Friday evening at the Stadium of Light that Ross hadn't lost the dressing room and the decision to sack him was made on underlying performance data. Ross lost 10 in 76. What does the underlying data tell us with Parkinson losing 6 in 10?
Yes, that underlying data isn't great, isn't it?
It's not the best.
And yeah, I guess you have to analyse data over a long period of time. But if he carries on at that level, then yeah, things are only going to get worse, aren't they? I was somebody that, and perhaps, you know, I think maybe the tide had certainly turned against Jack Ross. I would have liked to have seen him given more time to turn it around. I liked what he was doing in some respects. I completely understand the frustrations and, you know, there were far too many draws, etc. But I would have liked to have seen, I'm just sick and tired of the constant changing of managers. There have been just, you know, so many. I mean, in my lifetime, I since the early 70s, there have been a ridiculous number of managers. You know, Sunderland has been in existence since 1879. And I think, you know, something like 4/5 of the managers in that time have been kind of since 1980, something ridiculous like that. And that turnover has got ludicrous over the last few years. So that's, I mean, you know, I realise there are times when chairman and owners feel that, you know, you have to make a change. I would have liked to have seen Ross given a little bit more time to maybe turn things around. Now that Parkinson's here, well, again, you know, I mean, you can't just say and look at his record now and say, well, you've got to sack him because it's so bad. But how long do you give him if the results don't pick up, if the away form stays as it is, and if they're not picking up wins at home? Like, what will happen if they lose to Burton on Tuesday? And that would then be 1 point out of six at home. And, you know, people are going to start, the pressure is going to mount so quickly on Parkinson. But it would take a really drastic set of negative results for me to be of the opinion that he should be sacked, because I just don't think that there has been any form of progress whatsoever under this system of sacking managers as soon as things look like they're going a little bit wrong. I mean, would it have been any? Would Sunderland have been in a worse position now if Simon Grayson was still in charge? I know some fans will say yes, they would. He was dreadful. Would they though? I mean, would they? You know, they might well have got relegated still from the Championship. Would they have been in a worse situation in League One? I mean, Grayson had a decent record managing teams in League One. Might he have last season been able to turn things around a bit in League One if they'd kept with him? And all right, they'd have gone down in the Championship, and you know, he'd stayed and at least been able to gradually mould the squad to his liking. I would probably say I don't think they would be any worse than, you know, whatever they are now. What is it, 10th in,
could it be
in,
any worse?
In League One? Would it? Would, yeah. If they kept Grayson in charge, they'd have saved a bit of money because they wouldn't have had to pay off a couple of managers in the meantime as well. So, yeah, just stop sacking managers so regularly.
Yeah.
Please.
Maybe, I suppose there's two sides, isn't there? Stop sacking them and make sure you get the appointment right.
Well, can I just jump in here? Because
yeah, of course, you
know, because Bridie's raised Simon Grayson. Now, we had a conversation about Grayson yesterday at the game, and it's interesting because when you start analysing it and looking at what's going wrong, and Pridey's touched on it there, Grayson had a good record in League One and, you know, in the Championship. Then Jack Ross had an excellent record in Scotland, and it's arguably, you know, you can look back at last season and you can argue all day long whether it's a failure or was it not. He still only lost one game at home and only 6 points off getting automatic promotion.
Yeah.
And we come to Phil Parkinson, whose record in League One, League Two, Championship, again, is good. So if you take those factors together, you've got three managers with a lot of experience who'd actually, before they arrived at Sunderland, their records stand up to scrutiny in the levels at which they were working. Do they become bad managers overnight? No, I don't think they do. But then you look at, and we've touched on it today, talking about players, and players have to take some responsibility. And then you look at, start talking about, and Benno, we've talked about this a lot, recruitment. The recruitment at Sunderland over the last two, 3 years has been a shambles. You know, there's been times last season when Jack Ross was working when they didn't even have a scout, literally didn't have a scout because Tony Coton was undergoing surgery and they didn't have anybody to do any sort of recruitment. The recruitment process was such that Jack was having to suggest the style of players he would like, but there was no money for. So therefore you have to go to players having to try and get on free transfers. And you're putting together, you know, a sort of a squad made up of what we've got, bit part players who are not actually suited to purpose. And both managers now are trying to have to fashion something out of a group of players who are disparate, aren't really, you know, we said before, a League One squad that will get you out of League One. It's players picked out of different levels, hoping they'll come together and get you out of League One. So I think that spiral of sacking managers because the results aren't going the way you want them to go at the moment has got to stop. And someone has got to bite the bullet and say, right, we're going to have to suffer some pain for a month and 2 months or wherever it takes to allow a manager to actually build something and then have the trust in him, because you've got to start trusting these managers' CVs that they can do a job. But at the moment, nobody's been given that stability. Nobody's been given that chance to prove that over a period of time they can live up to their reputations, if you like.
Mm. I agree with Nick, what he said there in regards of, you know, you've got to lay the foundations. And how many managers have we sacked over the last, you know, shall we say, since we've been doing the
seven, Rebels? I guess.
We've been going through one a year, basically, yeah. On average. Yeah.
So, you know, we play the blame game. You know, at the end of the day, you know, it's get rid of the manager. Oh, we haven't spent enough money. But I think we've been saying this for years in regards of recruitment. And it's something which we brought up on Total Sport a couple of weeks ago when we had Gary Hours on, and we was talking about young players. We were talking about the last time we was in the so-called second division, third division, and you know, we just recalled about 14 or 16 young players who was playing when I was playing. You know, we were talking about the likes of Gordon Armstrong,
Gary Owers, your Martin Grays, Michael Grays, Brian Atkinson,
Dickie Yord,
Martin Smith, Craig Russell. You know, we can go on and on and on. Martin, you know, players at that time who was coming through the system. You know, we had about 14 or 15 players who was coming through the system.
Now, which it might be unfashionable to say this at the moment, but because it's not been out there, because it's not something that's current in terms of the current team and talking about the problems they've got in the first team. But Phil Parkinson's a big champion of the academy. Mm. They've sacked all the academy. Well, they've gone back to the base at the academy and starting all over again, because it's just absolutely critical they start getting good young players through the academy.
But
they're looking for a new academy head sort of recruitment to try and, who knows this area inside out, knows every football club in the Northeast, knows everybody connected with it, to start trying to blood young players through the system.
Because those players that Gary's mentioned there, all right, maybe some of them weren't world beaters, but they were all
local.
All good enough to play second tier level at the very least, weren't they? And all did a really good job in their own different ways.
Smithy was
at
great
that level.
Come to think of it, and he was given a chance at 17 or something like that.
Yeah. Exactly. And then you look at someone else that hasn't been mentioned there, Michael Bridges as
Michael
well.
Bridges.
A little bit later on, I know, but then, you know, he came through.
But
and,
you're only going to let that, that's only going to happen if you, like, for instance, you know, Phil Parkinson's here now. He's got a plan. He knows how to get teams promoted. He knows how important the academy is. So what do we do? Do we all throw our arms up and say, this football isn't good enough, you're losing games, you're a useless manager. Right, out you go. Another manager comes in, doesn't believe in the academy, and then this whole spiral starts again.
Yeah.
You've got to stop with someone who's got a plan, and which is, you know, in essence, is a rigid and workable plan, which at the moment, If Phil Parkinson believes in the academy and wants to get young players blooded and get a system working to get them through, well, it's not going to happen by January, but it could happen by a year's time, 2 years' time.
It's probably going to be 5 years, though. That's the thing.
May well be, but that patience, will it pay off in 5 years? It probably will, because there are clubs in the Football League, and Bournemouth is one of them, who've proved that with a bit of, you know, sticking with your manager, Eddie Howe being the case in point, Bournemouth, through all the rough times, look where Bournemouth are now.
Sean Dyche as well.
It's having a template. You know, what is Sunderland's template? I don't know. I don't know what sort of player they're looking for. You know, there's a lot of local talent, you know, but we don't actually, we keep changing the academy. Well, not changing the academy managers, we keep changing the managers, but they don't have any belief in the academy. You know, we've been talking about recruitment. You know, we can go back 10 years. You know, some of the players which we've actually brought into this football club, who's actually bringing them in? Is it the manager? Is it the chief exec who's bringing them players in? The amount of money which we've wasted? You know, so we've got to look at somebody who knows local talent, knows about the football in this area, and can build and hopefully start to bring one or two young players through the system. But first of all, you've got to have a template. You've got to have, what type of player are we looking for? The times we've talked about, we're too small. We're not quick enough. We're not physical enough. You know, so you're thinking, right, okay, first of all, we've got to find players who are quick, mobile, who's got a little bit of physicality about them. That's the sort of type of player you've got to be looking at. Everything else fits in. You know, I read about Arsene Wenger when he was looking for footballers. You know, what type of footballer was he looking for? Somebody who was athletic. Okay? You always can teach an athlete to become a footballer. You can't teach a footballer to become quicker.
No. Or to have heart.
So if you've got pace, if you've got pace, you can make him become a footballer.
Yeah.
Okay? But if you're a footballer, you're not going to make him become an athlete and become 100 meters.
Can you? I don't know.
Is that
something
you're not going to make him quicker?
Can you though? Because if 100 meter runners have coaches that make them quicker, could you not? Can you not make players quicker? I don't know. Is it possible? Is that something
fast,
to look at?
I guess, but, aren't they? In a sense,
it's the other way around. Yeah. I'm sure that if you've got somebody who's quick and who's athletic, you can teach them to play football.
Yeah.
If you've got somebody who's good at football, are you going to be able to make them quicker?
And you almost need that as the basics. You need to be quick and athletic and strong. And that's the basics. And then if you're a good footballer, well, that's a bonus.
Exactly.
I think what Ben was doing is advocating the signing of Usain Bolt.
well, in Australia,
didn't know he was the man. He's got a couple of goals.
Lewis Hamilton.
Because
he's good at corners, isn't he?
Oh, he'd do all right. Can't do any worse than what we're doing at the moment. Jeez.
Okay.
there's a good question regarding, I suppose, the management as well. And I think it's something I kind of agree with. And I think when I was touching before, and I think you said about sticking with someone, and I said stick with someone to make the right appointment, I kind of meant like something like this. I think sometimes, and again, feel free to disagree, absolutely, but I think sometimes the managers that succeed the best at Sunderland are the ones that have something about themselves. I mean, you look at Roy Keane, he did really quite well here, but he's done nothing anywhere else. So it's almost like he fitted this club. And maybe I felt the majority of the fans, me included, felt Parkinson maybe just wasn't the right bloke in that sense. But DJB_1976, and I'll throw it to Simon first again, but feel free, everyone, to just come in with your own opinion on it. He says, did the club miss a chance to energise the fan base by appointing Parkinson over maybe a Kevin Phillips and an experienced assistant manager combination? Since he's come in, performances have got worse, which we've touched on, but the fan base seems more divided than it has been for ages.
It's a really difficult one, that, isn't it? Because Kevin Phillips would have been a popular appointment with a lot of people simply because of what he did as a player at the club. He does have coaching experience. He's never been a manager. It would have been a gamble, but then again, isn't, in Sunderland's current predicament, any manager
a gamble.
Yeah. So yeah, I can see why people would have liked him. And then some people have said, well, he should have been assistant to somebody more experienced. Others have said what you've said there, he should have come in with an experienced assistant to kind of help him along, which, you know, I guess is possible. I know Phillips was very keen on the job. He would have jumped at the chance to manage Sunderland. Does he have the character, the personality for the job? Only time would have told. And will he be Sunderland manager one day? I think probably he will be. Whether he'll get another job somewhere else, he needs his first break in management, doesn't he? And you know, if Sunderland aren't going to give him that break now, I don't know if they ever will. So he needs to get his break somewhere else, do okay, and then be appointed by Sunderland, I guess. I must admit, I didn't think, you know, at one point he was the favourite, or one of the favourites, to take the job. I didn't think it would have been the right decision. I suppose part of that is because I fear for, you know, I don't like it when someone who's a hero at a club suddenly becomes vulnerable. I mean, if things, you know, and if results didn't go well for him and he plummeted down the league, well, fans would soon turn, and that's just the nature of it. And that would be such a shame to see for someone that won the European Golden Boot with Sunderland and was perhaps, you know, the best player that a lot of Sunderland fans now have seen in their lifetime. Yeah. But maybe you shouldn't consider that. Maybe if he's willing to take that risk, that's up to him. I mean, there's going to come a time perhaps when, you know, that's going to be the next way that Sunderland go, I suppose. They tried with Jack Ross to go with somebody who played a certain brand of football that was untested in English football, but, you know, certainly impressed the owners with what he said in his job interview and the way that he set out what he was trying to do. Now they've gone to somebody who's clearly got a record in League One and has got a record in getting promoted, and also has a certain brand of football with which he's associated. If that doesn't work, well, they will change him, even though I've kind of advocated sticking with somebody else. Maybe the next time they will think, right, well, I might as well just throw the dice, give it a real gamble. And you never know, Kevin Phillips might somehow have the charisma, the energy to turn things around. But unfortunately, I don't think it's as easy as that. And I would have my doubts. It would be a hell of a difficult task for him.
I'd echo what Bridie says. And I think the danger is that it's too easy to get, you know, this emotional sort of roller coaster that, well, let's get Kevin Phillips in. Let's get someone, the hero of the club, in. It's a brutal league. It's a brutal situation the club are in at the minute. The problems, you know, are manifest. We've talked about that. It's chewing up managers. It's spitting them out, because the problems aren't so much the managers themselves, it's what they're having to deal with. And I would fear for someone like Kevin Phillips coming in with no actual managerial experience now and having to combat all the things that he would have to combat behind the scenes to get a team out there that's winning games on a regular basis. If Kevin Phillips had just had the last fortnight that Phil Parkinson's had, would he be given any more grace from the supporters? No, he wouldn't. And it would be a horrible situation for Kevin to find himself in, you know, as a rookie manager, to have to deal with this situation. I think, like Simon says, Kevin's got to go and get the experience somewhere, either as an assistant manager or as a manager, to learn the ropes before you tackle a club which has got the size and the vocality that this support this club has. It's a massive club in that sense. It's a very pressured environment, and you know, even the best managers in the world find it difficult to cope with that pressure. So I think to ask someone like Kevin Phillips to walk into that, even though he'd have the, you know, a little bit more sort of breathing space, if you like, at the start, because it's Kevin Phillips, it doesn't take long for people to turn. And we've seen it at other clubs where heroes, you know, have gone in. It invariably doesn't work. I think, you know, history shows that it's a difficult environment and for club heroes to walk into. It's all well and good having that emotional attachment, but I think you've got to be sometimes a bit more pragmatic.
Again, we're highlighting Kevin Phillips. I think any manager who walks into Sunderland have got major, major problems. We've had some very, very good managers of this football club, and they've had the same problems. And I think it starts behind the scenes. I think there's a lot of things which are going on behind, which sort of, it's out of manager's hands.
Yeah.
And no matter who you bring in, okay, Phil Parkinson, if it doesn't go well, we'll sack him. We'll bring somebody else in. They're going to still have the same problems. Mm-hmm. Jack Ross had the same problems. You know, Dick Advocaat had the same problems. Martin O'Neill had the same problems. What's going on behind the scenes? Okay. And sometimes you put a manager up there and he's just up there, shall we say, fronting the football club. Really, he really wants to tell you the real issues which are going on, the real issues which they've got to deal with in regards of players. You know, we talk about Madger, for instance. We'll bring that one up in regards of why did we sell him? Did we have to sell him? You know, but can the manager come out and say the reasons why we had to sell him? If we would have kept him, do you think we would have got promotion? I think we would have gone up.
You're
talking about there's loads of issues which are going on behind the scenes, which as a manager, you can't really come out and say, by the way, this is happening, that's happening, I can do this, I can't
which,
do that,
which
I
is
can
exactly do exactly what happened with Jack Ross, who refused point blank to actually use it as an excuse because he knew it would come back, because that fans would say you're just making excuses. Mm-hmm. Now, Phil Parkinson, to my mind, to a certain extent, is doing the same. He's being very, very ultra defensive about the squad because he's not going to come out and start saying, actually, what I'm having to deal with at the moment is this, A, B and C.
But you've just mentioned, you know, you've just mentioned Phil Parkinson. You've mentioned Jack Ross. You must probably be able to mention another six or seven managers previously who's had the same problem.
One who managed to defy it, I guess, was Sam Allardyce, wasn't it? I know he was only there for a very short space of time, and who knows what would have happened if he'd stayed. There were a couple of reasons that he went. I think he was going anyway, wasn't he? And then England came along, of course. So who knows what would have happened had he been able to stay and had he been, crucially, backed as well. Because he did seem to be the right fit,
Sam,
didn't he?
He was the right fit in that sense. And crucially, the budget and the players he brought in that January worked for him. Mm. He actually hit gold dust in that sense in that January transfer window. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the rare January windows that actually has worked, and since Roy Keane, perhaps, and that's the six players he bought in that January. But yes, there were issues with Allardyce. Allardyce had his transfer budget slashed in the summer by half, and that was the point at which he said he wasn't going to stay. And
I think he was going to go anyway, wasn't he?
I think the England thing came up anyway, but which sort of clouded the situation. But he wasn't going to stay on the sole. But again, that highlights again the problem behind the scenes is a manager wasn't given what he was promised, and he wasn't going to stay as a consequence. So when you get the golden goose, Sunderland managed to shoot it. You know, it's a sort of that's sort of Sunderland all over, isn't it?
I wanted to ask Nick. I don't know how, and I'm probably putting you on the spot here, but I think when Jack Ross went, you mentioned a lot of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes would come out in the wash. To what you can actually say, what sort of things was he up against, to your knowledge?
Oh, like, where do we start? I mean, recruitment was one of them. You know, the lack of anybody really. Sort of solely dealing with the right recruitment. And to that end, you then talk about, I mean, Jack would often talk about how he wanted a budget. He wanted to be given a specific budget. Then he knew exactly what he could deal with. And he would use the analogy of, I think when he was at Alloa, he would say, right, I knew I could spend £150 a week on a left back, which left me £700 a week to buy a striker. So I knew the areas, the parameters in which I'm working. But he said, here, I was given no budget. No, it was always a case of, can we have this player? No. Can we have that player? Maybe. Can we have that one? No, you can't. Oh, well, we have to downgrade. Mm. What player can we get for this? And it just didn't allow him any sort of remit, really, to work constructively in building a squad that actually fitted the template that he had for a squad. So he was having to put out a team And he had to use tactics that play to the strengths of the individual players rather than the players playing to the strengths of the team and the tactics. That was just one instance of the problems that he had to deal with. I think he also felt that he was left a little bit marooned by the club in the structure sense. There was no chief executive to take a lot of the weight off his shoulders of the stuff he was doing behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. So his working day would end up, one example, he'd be on the training pitch till 12 o'clock, straight off the training pitch to do the press conference ahead of a game, which could take 2 hours. And then suddenly he'd find a group of visitors had turned up the Academy of Light and he'd been shown around for 3 hours. And then he said, I didn't actually get to sit down with my coaches till 5 o'clock in the evening to try and discuss what team we were putting out the weekend. So he says that's just an instance of the way the structure was working against him as an individual. He only had so many hours in a day, and he's finding that most of those hours in the day were being taken up with activities that were better suited for a director of football or a chief executive at the football club, because the structure isn't in place. So, slowly but surely, the interviews that Jack's giving, he's starting to open up a bit more about the problems he was having to deal with. But it all comes back to what we've been saying all along, is you've got to have the right structures in place behind you and the right mechanisms in place in recruitment if you're going to make it work on the pitch with the first team.
I think a good example is obviously the Will Grigg scenario.
Oh, there's another example which completely taken out of his hands.
Could do our own podcast on this, I think, couldn't we?
I think Netflix will have this one covered.
Yes. It's just like Nick just mentioned there in regards of a budget. You need a budget. You need to know what you're working with, how much you can spend and wheel and deal. If you haven't got a budget, then, whoever you fancy bringing into your club, you go and they'll say yes or no. I go back to when I was manager at Darlington. I had a budget. You had X amount of pounds and that's it. You can't go above that. If you went above that, then you have to wheel and deal, get rid of somebody to obviously create a little bit of space to bring somebody else in. Mm-hmm. But again, it's about recruitment. Who's actually signing the players? Because you look at one or two players who were signed for Sunderland and it raised one or two eyebrows and you're thinking, whoa. Why have we brought him? We can look at the Grant Ledbetter scenario when we had Lee Cattermole. Mm-hmm. People were thinking, well, we don't really need Grant Ledbetter.
Yeah, it wasn't the type of player required.
We required. And then you look at the Will Grigg scenario. He's coming to the football club. No, we needed another striker. But then you're thinking, well, how was he going to fit in? How was Jack Ross going to fit him in? Especially when he had Charlie White coming back from injury. So... Yeah. Did Jack bring him in? Or did a chief exec bring him in?
The problem for Jack Ross, that Grigg became a big encumbrance to him in the sense that he knew by the end of the window on that January that he accepted that they weren't going to get Grigg. And he certainly wasn't prepared to pay over the odds for him. Player he liked, he says Grigg's a good player, but in the circumstances, it was a player that he wasn't going to chase. It became Stuart Donald's personal crusade, if you like, to sign him. So when Jack went home at 8 o'clock on the Friday night, or whatever day of the week it was, the window, he'd accepted that Grigg wasn't coming to the football club and he was happy that Sterling was coming in. He said, I can work with what I've got, but I'm not going to start chasing Will Grigg and paying stupid money for him. But that became Stuart Donald, as I say, his personal crusade, and ended up in a price tag, which in the end became an encumbrance because other football clubs then looked at Sunderland saying, oh, well, look at Sunderland, they're the big spenders. They're the big spenders in this league. They've got Will Grigg, they can spend $4 million on this player. They upped the prices. They were looking to pay for other players then, because agents are then saying, oh, well, hang on a minute, you can afford this for X because you paid $4 million for Will Grigg.
But, you just touched on it there. Brought in the lad from Tottenham, Sterling. Mm-hmm. How much game time did he have?
Played.
Why did we bring him to the football club for?
And he actually game, he actually got about 20 minutes and he did all right.
I think, and as you said, Jack Ross was quite happy with just him. And he probably would have got more game time if Grigg hadn't been brought in. And then
because
there was
Grigg came in.
Because he came in on big money, he probably felt obliged to play him more than perhaps he would have liked to. Somebody asked on Total Sport whether, because Josh Madger has since come out and said that he would have stayed at Sunderland if the deal had been right. I mean, is Will Grigg being paid more than what Josh Madger wanted? I don't know. I mean, when you throw in the transfer fee for Grigg as well, has it been more expensive to have Will Grigg than it would have been to have kept Josh Madger on a contract that he would have accepted.
I would have thought so.
Very possibly. So, just again, I don't know, that's when you come back to those two words, typical Sunderland, isn't it?
That's what those decisions need to be, I suppose. Because I read the interview and I felt Madger was basically saying more money. And that, I think when you're a fan, it does naturally go against you. But when you look at it more objectively like you just have, you're probably right. It probably would have been more beneficial to actually just pay him what he wanted, keep a striker that fits into the team, is better, is liked by everyone at the club, rather than like just chucking a load of money at a guy that evidently hasn't worked. But we've got two left. So I'll leave one for you, Sam. Then the other one's just for Nick and Benno. But Michael Bowers from SAFC TV, lovely lad all around. He says, what do you think about the, and he puts in inverted commas, Donald and Methven are chances and Charlatans angle that some have come out with? What? All chip in with that if you want. It's a big topic, isn't it?
I don't think they're charlatans or chances or anything. I think that is actually disrespectful. I think Stuart Donald, I think basically Stuart likes to please everybody. I think he sometimes comes out and says what he thinks people want to hear. And that actually in the long run ties himself in knots because he can't remember who he's told what. But I don't think it's because he's a charlatan or a chancer. I think it's because he generally wants to get it right. He does believe in the football club and he wants to make it work. And Charlie's Charlie. I think you've got to take Charlie in the same way that you take Boris Johnson or anyone else who went to.
Is that a good thing?
Well, I think what you do. What I mean by that is you see this sort of flamboyant, preposterous figure, if you like, who goes bounds around making preposterous statements and then having to recant them, and someone else has to come out and say, actually, that wasn't quite right. But actually, again, Charlie has the club at heart.
He doesn't
want it to go wrong. Neither of them want it to go belly up. Neither of them want it to fail. They're both working their hardest to make it work. But I think what we see is the manifestation of their characters. Mm-hmm. We're seeing, you know, Charlie being Charlie and Stuart trying to please everybody.
Very sensitive man, Stuart. I mean, we've had him in here a few times, and I sometimes do get frustrated because sometimes people say they want it to go well so it lines their pockets. I don't agree with that. In my experience, I think exactly what you've said. You've actually said it in the way I wish I could have articulated it myself. I think it is manifestations of each other's character, and Charlie will rub people up the wrong way because of the man that he is. Do I think either of them don't want Sunderland to do well? They both desperately want something to do well, and for the fans, not just for themselves and not just to line their pockets.
You have to take Stuart Donald at face value, I think. And as Nick says, he's sometimes maybe tied himself up in knots a little bit. Whenever he's been on BBC Newcastle, he's always, I think, been open and honest and tried to answer questions as thoroughly as he can. And, you know, people talk about him, you know, being a charlatan, lying, etc. I don't think he does. I think he basically just tries to explain things as best he can, and I take him at face value, and I'm certainly giving him the benefit of the doubt. And I think that I've appreciated his openness, because not all football club owners are like that. I think he's explained, you know, the recent investment from FPP. I think he's explained that as best he can. He came on the show recently and talked about that, and I think that at least appeased a few people and made them realise that, he's actually doing his best. And he managed to convince us that certainly, you know, he stands to lose more than anybody if things don't work at Sunderland. And if this loan that they now have, if they default on the payments, that, well, it'll be him, Stuart Donald, that will lose the most. Him and Juan Sartori that, you know, have invested that money in Madrox, the parent company. So, I think if things do eventually go well, it might be the case that he does, in the long run, make some money from the football club. In which case, you wouldn't.
I think he's entitled to do that.
I also think he stands to, you know, he stands to lose a lot.
I think what's happened with Stuart is that I think he's been too open. I think when you look at football clubs and football owners, I think there's nobody else who's done what Stuart's done. Especially with his relationship with the media, his relationship with the supporters. He's been on board and he's made the supporters and everybody else know what's happening. And maybe he's given out too much, shall we say, expectations, what they're going to do. Maybe, you know, if he says we're going to get a striker, we're going to get a striker. No matter what, he's going to push that through. You know, so I just think that Stuart tells you.
And I think that's it. You know, the Will Griggs saga, yeah. It was for the best intentions, but it didn't work.
But because he said he was going to get his strikers and he's, shall we say, built the supporters up, they're thinking, oh, we're going to get a new striker and he's going to be. We went out and got a striker. So I think, you know, Stuart said he can take the club as where he can take it as far as he hasn't got the finance, as he said.
If he got to the start,
you know, from the start, if he went to the Championship, that's when he's been looking for investment. You'll be looking, hopefully, for somebody else to take it on to the next step. He's been, you know, well opened about that. Mm.
So the final question, we're going to leave it on a positive here, right? So it was a question that was aimed from our very own Gavin, towards Benno and Nick. Is there any great stories from the road that stick out massively in your head? Let's end it on a positive.
Oh, I can't tell that.
Can't say what happened. I said,
Nick's missus is here, so I can't say anything about that.
Outrageous.
That is outrageous, actually. I'll have words with you.
Causing
tell you what, trip to Gillingham in a fortnight is going to be interesting now.
I think...
I can never get anything out of them about this, so if I can't, I bet you can't either.
No.
Well, one thing which does stand out, you know, when we talk about our trips. I think the good thing is that, you know, we've been going 16, 17 years. And one thing which you've got to have a good relationship, you know, because we spend so much time together.
We're married, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got to have an understanding. And you know, hopefully me and Nick have got that. But one trip which does stand out is the Stoke trip when we played Stoke a few years ago.
Oh,
in the snow.
We were. Do you remember the snow?
Yeah. James McQueen.
Poor old Benno, we were stuck in the car on the A50 and in the snow trying to get out of Stoke. It took us, 8 hours to do 2 miles, but Benno needed the toilet. So he was sat, poor old Benno, in the car for however many hours it was, absolutely desperate to get out, to go to the toilet. He couldn't because he was surrounded by cars. In the end, we get out of Stoke. Pull over, and I thought we were going to get stuck in the snowdrift then, or for Benno to go on the distance. And...
Didn't you have a bottle or something?
No, nothing. It was poor old Benno. It was
weren't that equipped. But no, we've had one or two interesting journeys.
Now you think ahead and you've always got a bottle on hand, just in case it's snows and stuff.
Survival.
We broke down once, didn't we, on the way to Southampton? We ended up...
Yes. Your car did or you did?
Both of us, both the car and us. When we broke down beside the road near Oxford and we ended up in Milton Keynes trying to get to Southampton one
That's
night.
Right, yes, correct.
Fantastic. Well, thanks as always to our host, Sunderland University. Thanks to all the guests, Simon. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Nick, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Benno, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Please remember to subscribe on iTunes or whatever you listen to your podcasts on to the Roker Report podcast. Make sure you get all the latest podcasts as soon as they're released. But also make sure you subscribe to BBC Newcastle's Sunderland AFC podcast to hear much more from today's guests. But apart from that, thanks very much, lads. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.